Thank you so much for coming out to the third of our lectures in the Distinguished Speaker Series, Astronomy of the 21st Century. I'm Sally Uy. I'm from the Department of Astronomy, and with me is Gary Forman, the President of the Student Astronomical Society, a member of UAC, and Amy Harris, Director of the Exhibit Museum of Natural History. And in addition to these groups, this series is also generously funded by the Michigan Center for Theoretical Physics. As you know, we're celebrating the International Year of Astronomy with the theme semester at the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts. We have a very rich program that I hope many of you have had a chance to check out, including stargazing opportunities and exhibitions, classes, performances, and many activities, including other lecture series. I especially also wanted to mention that we do have some exhibitions, including one that just opened at the University Library online called Divine Sky, which is a wonderful exhibit that you don't even have to leave your house for, of astronomical memorabilia, including old historical atlases and charts and other beautiful historical holdings from our own collections. We also have the other exhibitions in the library, including the exhibition Out of This World of Astronomical Images in the Hatcher Gallery right here on Central Campus, as well as the display of the Galileo manuscript right now in the Special Collections Library, also in the Hatcher Gallery together with other rare manuscripts from that collection. And in the Slusser Gallery at the School of Art and Design, we still have ongoing the exhibition of astronomy-themed fine art. So we have that as well as many other fabulous activities going on at the Exhibit Museum and elsewhere. So this evening we are especially delighted to have with us Professor Andrea Ghez from the University of California, Los Angeles. Professor Ghez did her undergraduate work at MIT and then her graduate work at the California Institute of Technology, which she completed in 1992. She then went on to a prestigious Hubble Fellowship at the University of Arizona before being recruited to the faculty at the University of California in 1994, where she has remained ever since. Professor Ghez is especially known for her exquisite high-resolution imaging work, which she has always done with the very latest techniques, and she has applied these techniques to star-forming regions, binary stars, and especially to the very center of our own Milky Way galaxy, which we will be hearing about. And Professor Ghez has received numerous accolades and honors, including a Packard Fellowship, a Sloan Fellowship. She's received the Maria Geppert Mayer Award from the American Physical Society, as well as the Newton Lacey Pierce Prize from the American Astronomical Society. She's an elected member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And most recently, only a few months ago, she was named a 2008 MacArthur Fellow. Professor Ghez is quite selective in where she makes her appearances, so we are especially delighted and honored to have us to have her with us tonight.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. So when I first got to UCLA, I was a new young professor, and I was looking for a new question to ask. And the question that I decided would be fun to address is the question, is there a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy? And what I hope to convince you in the next hour or so is that the answer is yes. Now, to make sense of the first question, we have to ask a few more. First, what is a black hole? Second, why might one exist at the center of our galaxy? In other words, why did we ask this question? And third, what is the proof? And of course, this proof has to differ from that found often in academic hallways. In fact, as I've gotten older, I've realized this actually gets used more often than not. So let's start with, what is a black hole? Well, a black hole is a region of space where the pull of gravity is so intense that nothing can escape it, not even light. So this makes them very difficult to study. I love the Sid Harris cartoon of it. It's the elusive that appeals to me, which I think is one of the reasons that black holes are so fascinating to people. So let's look at a few other ways of defining what a black hole is. A black hole is actually a mass that's confined to effectively zero volume. In other words, we can't assign it a size. So classically, this means that the quantity density, which is just mass over volume, since the volume goes to zero, that quantity goes to infinity. And in physics, we call this a singularity. And the reason this is important is that singularities usually tell you you don't have your physics quite right. Okay, so we don't actually understand black holes very well. And presumably, when we understand how to make the study of things that are very small, that's the study of quantum mechanics, work together with the field of the things, well, general relativity, which is the study of things with a lot of gravity, we'll figure out what a black hole actually is. And people who do string theory are hoping that they have the answer. But in the meantime, it turns out I get to ignore the small detail that we can't actually explain what a black hole is. And that's because while the physical object of a black hole is not thought to have, well, it's thought to have some size, just some size we can't actually explain or understand, it's so small, there is a finite or a large scale that I can associate with a black hole that's really quite important to this object. And it's known as the event horizon or the Schwarzschild radius. And this is the radius, which is the last point at which we can receive any light from the object. In other words, once we go inside the event horizon, we can't communicate with the things that are outside it, which gives rise to all sorts of wonderful science fiction-y things. The other aspect of this size is that it turns out that if I can compress any object to its Schwarzschild size, and it turns out the size is proportional to mass. If I measure the mass in units of mass of the sun, I get the Schwarzschild radius if I multiply that number by 3 in units of kilometers. So to give you the sense of this, if I could figure out, let me actually back up 1 second. The Schwarzschild radius, so if I could figure out how to squeeze an object down to its Schwarzschild radius, it turns out at that point, there is no force that we know of that can oppose the force of gravity, and the object has to collapse to become a black hole. Okay, so to give you a sense, if I could squeeze the size of the Earth into the size of a sugar cube, the Earth would be forced to become a black hole. If I could take the sun and compress it, I believe, to probably the size of University of Michigan's campus, the sun would have to become a black hole. So gravity wins at this point, but this also gives me the proof. To prove that there is a black hole, I need to show that there's an object that's confined to its Schwarzschild radius. In other words, a very small volume. So a lot of mass inside a small volume is the proof of a black hole. Now, where do black holes show up? Because I've started this talk telling you I'm going to find no ordinary black hole. I'm going to find a supermassive one. And that's because, in fact, in astronomy, we distinguish between the ordinary black holes, which were actually predicted from the theoretical ideas or thoughts about how very massive stars would evolve. So if stars are born with more than 20 to 30 times the mass of the sun, these stars, these are the, I guess I like to call these the party animals of the universe. They burn through their fuel really quickly and then explode and very dramatically turn into black holes at their end of their lives. And that was predicted theoretically. They have masses, the mass of the black hole that's left is only roughly 3 times the mass of the sun. They were predicted, and because we see massive stars before they explode everywhere in our galaxy, we think these little black holes, or ordinary black holes, are scattered throughout our galaxy. And we call these stellar remnants simply because they're the remnant of the evolution of very massive stars. So this is a part of the story where we predicted from theory that something should exist, and then observations prove that these things did exist. On the other hand, there are the supermassive black holes. And what do we mean? We just mean that they're really big. And in fact, to be specific, they're 1 million to 1 billion times the mass of the sun. So much bigger than these little 3 times the mass of the sun objects. And these things are found at the center of the galaxy, center of galaxies. And these things were not predicted theoretically, but rather observations suggested that this was true. And now we're turning to our theoretical colleagues to ask them, well, what's up with this? How do we form them? All right, so I've mentioned galaxies. I would like to introduce just say a few words about galaxies. Behind this, the words is a rather famous picture taken with Hubble Space Telescope And behind it, you see galaxies of all sorts and shapes and sizes. So a galaxy is just a huge collection of stars, gas, and dust that are held together by their own mutual gravity. Okay, so galaxies come in all shapes and sizes. We live in one, our own sweet home, the Milky Way galaxy. And actually, in Michigan, it's probably dark enough here when you go out at night that you can actually see it. This is basically impossible in Los Angeles. You have to go out to the desert to see it. So you can see it. We live in the middle of this flattened disc-like structure. And the sun is about halfway out. So if we could get outside our galaxy and look back, our galaxy would look roughly like this, and our sun is in a spiral arm, and the distance to the center of the galaxy, well, it takes light 26,000 years to get from the center of the galaxy to us. Now, what gave rise to the notion that these supermassive black holes existed at the center of galaxies? And that came from observations of galaxies that are called active galactic nuclei, or AGN for short. And these are simply galaxies whose nuclei are active. So this is a radio picture of a galaxy. The galaxy itself is basically this scale, and emanating out from the center are these huge jets. And we can measure how fast these jets are moving and estimate the mass, which tells us the energy. And the energy output of this galaxy, the rate of energy coming out, is enormous. So one has to invoke a rather large potential, or engine rather, to explain these jets. And so that's what gave rise to the notion that maybe these active galactic nuclei had supermassive black holes. And these were black holes that turned out had to be accreting a lot of material to give rise to the activity that we see both at its core and these jets. So the model here is you have a black hole that is having an incredible feast on the nearby stuff at the center of the galaxy. Now that gave rise to the question, do normal galaxies, a galaxy like our own, have have quiet black holes lurking at their centers? And this is basically asking, are there black holes on a diet? Because you don't see them, or emitting the material. And the emission is really coming from the material falling down onto the black hole, because the black hole itself doesn't emit anything. If we're going to ask this question, do normal galaxies, which are 90% of the galaxies out there, have black holes, it turns out that the Milky Way is simply the best place to address this question. The first reason is, it's the closest example of the center of a galaxy we're ever going to have to study. The next closest center of a galaxy is 100 times further away, so it's much harder to get the detail that we can in our own galaxy. Now, like in life, for every pro, there's usually a con. And the con is, we live in the middle of our galaxy. And remember, I said that the galaxy is this flattened disc-like structure, and that there's a lot of stars and dust. And the dust is problematic. I'm from Los Angeles. I understand this extremely well, because it turns out dust is just like smog. Well, it is smog. And the properties of the dust in our galaxy are very much like the particulate matter in the air in LA. So it's very difficult to see long distances through this stuff. So if you look in the optical, what your eye detects, only one out of every 10 billion photons, or light packets, that are emitted at the center of the galaxy makes it to us, which means it's invisible. You can't see the center of the galaxy at optical wavelengths. But if you go just longward of what your eye detects to the infrared, one out of every 10 makes it to you. So you actually see something. And this is these are the wavelengths that your TV remote control works at. Now, I've said that our galaxy is ordinary garden variety, nothing particularly special about it, but I lied just a little bit. At the center of the galaxy, there's an unusual radio source, and we gave it the name Sagittarius A star, simply because it's in the constellation of Sagittarius. That's the teacup, so if you actually can find that constellation and see, it pours into the center of the galaxy. So that kind of gives you the arrow to the center of the galaxy. A, because it was the brightest thing out there, and star because somebody was getting clever, because it's not a star. It's caused a lot of confusion. But the emission here doesn't look like the emission. I mean, it might in this picture, but if you look at it over several wavelengths, it doesn't look like the emission from a star. In fact, what it looks like is a very faint active galactic nuclei, like maybe a black hole having a little snack. So when we ask, is there a black hole at the center of the galaxy, we'd also like to know whether or not the black hole is sitting right there with this unusual radio source. Okay. So now I'm going to ask you guys a question. You guys get to ask me lots later, so I can ask you something now. How do you find something you can't see? Anyone want to venture an answer?
Gravity.
Gravity, yeah. We use gravity. Black holes have a lot of it. There's no shortage of it. So while we can't see the black hole, we can actually measure its influence on other things, its gravitational influence. So we're going to watch how stars nearby orbit. And stars orbit the center of our galaxy just like the planets orbit the sun. And it turns out that that's a very useful thing because the orbits of stars allow us to weigh how much mass is inside the orbit. So you get the enclosed mass. This means actually that we can measure the mass of the sun from knowing the orbital properties of the planets. And it turns out that there are two techniques for measuring the orbits of stars and getting the mass inside. One I like to call the impatient method, or I fondly call this the pre-tenure method. I don't have a lot of time to wait. And again, to give you maybe some context, which might be a little bit deceptive, it takes the sun 200 million years to get around the center of the galaxy. That time scale goes down as you get closer to the center, and it depends what's at the center. But if you aren't patient, the way to do this is you just measure parts of the orbit. You measure how fast these stars are moving on average, and measure their average distances. And that tells you how much mass is inside the average of the star's distances. Remember, the proof of a black hole is I need mass and I need a size. I need to show a lot of mass inside a very small volume or radius. The patient method, or the post-tenure method, they can't fire me now, method, is that you wait for them to go all the way around and you get masses from every single orbit. And this is useful because this impatient method means I have to make a lot of assumptions about how stars might orbit the black hole, about how they're distributed, but we do this all the time. We're really good at making these assumptions and getting a statistical estimate. But this is really assumption-free, so I'm much more confident of the answer that I get with this method, and because I get it from individual stars, I get to get much closer to the black hole because I don't have to do this on average. I don't have to average a bunch of stars and therefore take the average distance. Okay, so let's look at the possibilities. I'm going to start by going through the first technique. There's basically only two outcomes for this experiment. Either there is a black hole or there isn't. So if there is a black hole, then the mass that affects all the orbits is from a single point. So no matter how close to the black hole, I'm going to see the same mass. And it turns out that what that means for the velocities or the speeds is that these things are going to get faster as I get closer to the center of the galaxy, just like actually Mercury is going much faster than the Earth. And if you care about the math, you expect a relationship that the speeds go as 1 over the square root of r. If you don't care about the math, you just know that I see things that are faster in the center than things that are further out if there's a black hole. If there's no black hole, then the mass that is making things orbit, because things will orbit the center of the galaxy even if there is no black hole, that mass is distributed throughout this whole area. So the mass that's inside the closest orbit is smaller than the mass that's enclosed by this larger orbit. And what this means is that the speeds or velocities don't increase as you get closer to the black hole. It remains roughly constant. So it's a nice, straightforward experiment. I'm looking for speeders at the center of the galaxy. So I'm inward bound because it's the stars that are closest to the center that are the keys. Now, you might ask, this seems like a simple experiment. Why didn't anyone do this before? And the answer is that there are a lot of stars at the center of the galaxy. And it turns out that the density of stars gets higher as you go to the center. And you might be able to perceive this from this picture that was taken by the Gemini telescope in Hawaii. This is where the center of the galaxy is. This is X marks the spot. It's where the radio source is. And the density is going up. So that means that the It's much more difficult to separate the individual stars in the center than it is at larger radii. And astronomers have this technical term for it. You become confusion limited. It's actually how I feel sometimes, but it's just what happens when you don't have enough resolution. So this means that to see the individual stars, you need the ability to see a lot of detail, which is high. You need high spatial resolution. And it turns out that the larger your telescope is, in principle, the better your ability to see the detail is. So you have higher resolution. So what I need is a big telescope. And fortunately, that's what I get by being at the University of California. I have access to the Keck telescopes, which are the largest telescopes in the world. It's a collaboration between the University of California, Caltech, and NASA. And UCLA is the Center for Infrared Astronomy in that consortium. So if you're an infrared astronomer, that's a nice place to be. So that's why I like being at UCLA. So this is a nice telescope. Where did we build it? So I'm going to ask you another question. You might know the answer. Some of you might already know the answer, but Hawaii. So it's not a bad place. If you've ever been there, it's up. The observatory is up on Mauna Kea. The headquarters are in Waimea. Now I'm going to ask you another. Why would you build it in Hawaii? What makes Hawaii one of the best places in the world to do astronomy? In fact, there are countries from all over the world that have put their telescopes on Hawaii. Light pollution, less light. Not too many lights. In fact, that's one. It's Hawaii. Okay, so that was my first slide. It's a great place to go on vacation. What else? Altitude, you're really high. You're above most of the content in the atmosphere. The water absorbs it, so you really want to be as high as possible. Any other reasons? Right. Gosh, you guys are great. You're getting them all. Okay, so it's above the clouds was one. So you're high in the atmosphere. So this is actually a picture I took on the way up to the summit. And you can see that most of the time, because you might think Hawaii, it's a tropical place. It's wet and rainy there, but not up at the summit. We're up at 14,000 feet. It's very barren place. In fact, right up here is called Apollo Valley, because when they did the Apollo missions to the moon, they thought that maybe this is a terrain that would look like the moon. So early astronaut training took place here. It turns out it's also a very difficult place to work, 14,000 feet. People don't operate that well up there. Telescopes operate great, but people don't. So if you've ever hiked up to high altitudes, you'll know that there are a couple interesting physiological effects. One thing that's rather unfortunate about being at altitudes, you become very forgetful and rather stupid. So one of the first arguments I had with my grad students up there when we started this experiment was, none of us could actually get this straight, which is rather amazing from sea level. We were discussing what 128 divided by 2 was, and we couldn't get it right. So it turns out that, thank goodness, we actually have made some progress. The astronomers actually don't observe from the summit anymore. We did until 1997. Then we started observing from Waimea. There's a data control center there, and you can actually control the telescope from sea level. And now we've even gone one step further, which is we have a remote observing room in UCLA, so we don't even go to Hawaii anymore, which is kind of a disappointment. We actually go, I have to confess, we do go once a year because it's really important to make contact with the observatory staff. And my grad students really like the trip. Okay. So the other thing you'll notice is that we're on a volcano. So this is Mauna Kea. We're looking at Mauna Loa. Mauna Loa exploded in 1984. So you might think, what are we doing on a volcano? Well, it turns out that there are three kinds of volcanoes. They're the active ones. So Hawaii, the Big Island, which is where this is composed of five volcanoes. One is active, which this is a picture I took again back when I made my first trip. You could get 2 feet from the lava flow. It was really spectacular, but again, kind of scary. What if this thing explodes? But the geologists tell me, and I have to trust them because I'm married to one, that Mauna Kea is a dormant, unfortunately not extinct. I'd rather the extinct solution, but it's not going to explode for another million or so years. Let's hope they're right. Okay, somebody else mentioned here that the airflow is really smooth, and this comes from being in the center of an ocean. So the airflow is very smooth, and that means that our view of the universe is not too badly affected by the atmosphere, but I'm going to come back to that in a minute. And then somebody else mentioned, first off, that light pollution is low, and it turns out that Hawaii is one of the few places in the world where astronomy is high in terms of economic impact. We're the number two industry in Hawaii, second to, you might guess, tourism. So we can actually request certain things. Like, if you've ever been to Hawaii, you might notice that the lights are very yellow there. And that's because all street lights aren't just the fluorescent white lights that we tend to have around here, but rather tuned to a very specific wavelength. So they're only emitting at a particular wavelength. So the astronomers just notch it out. We don't care. It's not there. We see all the rest unaffected. All light covers are protected on the top, so they are all downward pointing. There's no pollution on the top. And then the ironic part, which is going to become more ironic in just a second, we asked that the hotels do no laser light shows, and they listen. all right, you'll see the humor in that in a minute. Getting time on Keck, it's like any telescope, it's competitive. You can apply twice a year. There's a nice website that you can check out, nice, pretty pictures from the Keck telescope. Now, having a large telescope buys you, in principle, two things. The ability to see very faint things, because it's a big light bucket, kind of like a rain bucket, you get to collect more light. And it turns out large telescopes has kept that promise. I like to call it this, like, there's two campaign promises that followed through very well on that one. And the other one was the one I mentioned a minute ago, which is this ability to see very fine detail. So the larger your telescope, the finer the detail. But that's actually been much more difficult to achieve. And what's the problem? The problem is, in the last 30 microseconds of light's journey to the Earth, and think about these photons that have been traveling for 26,000 years from the center of our galaxy, and on astronomical scales, that's nothing. In the last 30 microseconds, it hits the atmosphere. Great for us, allows us to survive, but a real headache for astronomy. And they basically go splat. So they say, you know, accidents happen close to home, and that's true in this case. So these are five bright stars at the center of the galaxy. If there were no atmosphere, this would be a completely static picture, and each star would be the size of the smallest structure that you're seeing here. So it's the atmosphere that is causing all this problem. And it's continuously changing. It's basically changing on scales that correspond to the motion in the jet stream in our atmosphere. Now, this causes a factor of 20 loss in angular resolution. And now that's a lot. I mean, can you imagine if somebody said, we're going to pay you a factor of 20 more tomorrow, or you had a factor of 20 more kids, you know, you'd notice. Okay, so astronomers are clever types. You know, give them a problem, they're going to come up with a solution. So one solution to the atmosphere is you get above it. And that's the solution of Hubble Space Telescope. It's worked wonderfully for many years. But it's important to recognize that its diameter, and the diameter of the telescope is the key parameter for understanding the detail that you can see, is only 2.4 meters, while the Keck and other large telescopes have a diameter of 10. So this is a factor of 4 different. So if I can figure out how to beat the atmosphere with the Keck telescope from the ground, I can actually see more detail. I can't do this everywhere, but if I can, I can do it over a narrow field of view. So I've spent much of my career working on techniques for beating the atmosphere, and there's been a huge evolution in the technology here. We started off with a very simple technique of saving all those short exposures that I was showing you before, and you basically bring them all home, and you work incredibly hard to get the information out of those fast-moving pictures. And I think there were probably 5 people in the U.S. who bothered with this. So it cut down on the competition, that was sure for sure. But, you know, it was a pretty limited technique. A huge step forward was made with adaptive optics. And adaptive optics is a technique where you actually, in real time, correct the atmosphere with optical elements. So basically, the light from the star comes in, gets distorted by the atmosphere, and I like to think of this as like it becomes, rather than being flat, structured like a circus funhouse mirror, so it looks completely distorted. And what this adaptive optics system does is it puts another set of mirrors that undoes what the circus funhouse of mirror of the atmosphere does. So basically, it's the reverse, or the conjugate, and it's changing on really short timescales because it has to keep up with the atmosphere. Now, turns out the military was really good at this because the military also likes to look up through the atmosphere or equivalently down. And so as the astronomers started trying to develop this technology and asking the government for a lot of money to do so, the government finally fessed up that they knew full well how to do this. So it became declassified in the early 90s. Early 90s. And so there was a period of technology transfer into the astronomical community, and the Keck telescope was one of the first large telescopes to use this, and now we use lasers, which is the ironic part with the hotel business. Why is this not moving forward? Oops. Okay, so here's our laser. This is the first large telescope with a laser working with the adaptive optics system. So now we create an artificial star in the sky. There's a whole bunch of interesting things to say, but I'm going to stop there. You create an artificial star. It tells you how basically the stars twinkle because of the atmosphere, and you can take it out with your adaptive optics system. And this gives you a sense. This is, again, the picture of the center of the galaxy. These are the five bright stars we were looking at before on these really short exposures. And now we go from a very long exposures where you basically integrate over all that or add up all those messy, speckly things that I was showing you before, and it makes those these blobs, and then you turn on your adaptive optics system, and ta-da, you see clarity. And the key here is this is where the center of the galaxy is, where that black hole is. And if we expand out here, you can see that if I don't use this technology, I really can't see the stars, which is why you couldn't do this experiment without the advent of adaptive optics, because now I can see the stars, and I can see how they move. So the key to this experiment now is to understand whether or not these things are moving, or these things in here are moving really fast compared to these things out here. And then ultimately, we want the individual orbits. And it turns out the motions on the sky, on the plane of the sky, were really easy. And I like to show this picture because it reminds me to tell you a story. And this is particularly useful for the undergrads or anyone who has the younger people who are thinking about doing anything in life. I don't know why it came out that way. I started in 1994, and so I put my very first proposal to do this experiment in, and this august community called the Time Allocation Committee, which reviews the proposals, said, your funky technique of speckle imaging is unlikely to work, and even if it does, you're not going to see anything. So I got turned down. And so the lesson is, never take no for an answer. So I fortunately had some very generous colleagues that allowed me to take some of their precious telescope time. And believe me, it is incredibly precious. The average astronomer within the UC system gets a total of 4 nights per year. So you don't mess around, because basically your entire career is based on those 4 nights. So I had a very generous colleague who let me use a few hours of his telescope time to demonstrate that the technique went, and then we went back. And now we get telescope time, and we're actually quite piggy. But you can see from this picture, and this is only the central little box from that previous animation. These are the stars, so you can see them. And 4 years later, you can see that they're at a radically different position than they were in 1995. So they moved a lot. And in fact, you basically just had to take freshman physics to know that they were going to move a lot if there was a black hole. But we measure the positions on the sky as a function of time. So what we basically do is make a movie. So this is the east-west position as a function of time, north-south as a function of time. These are our first 3 images. The first 2 give you a slope, which is the speed. The third point gives you means you believe it. So this is when we published our first results, and now we have a lot more detail for reasons that I'll show you in a minute. And the positional accuracy that we can get to do these measurements is rather remarkable. I should have switched this. I guess I can switch this around. It's almost, actually, this is for the original experiment. So it would be, if you were in New York looking at somebody in Los Angeles, you could see them moving their finger like this. And that was the original experiment with speckle imaging. And now it's a factor of 10 better. So I don't know, it's like being able to see, I don't know, the width of your fingernail or something in New York, or go further away. Okay, so we see the speeds. This is a map. This is an early map. So this is north, south. This is east, west. The positions of the original stars are shown here. The size of the circle is scaled to the speed. There are big dots in the middle, small dots out here. That means there's a lot of mass, and that's where the weird radio source is. So that tells you that there's a lot of mass concentrated at that radio source. We have to do this in one dimension, or look at the actual values, and we see that it actually does fall off as 1 over the square root of r. That means all the mass that's affecting these guys' motion, we believe, is inside this distance. Now, the key question is, how close are you to the event horizon, or the Schwarzschild radius? Because I think that there's about 3 million times the mass of the sun, at least from this experiment, that was the number we were saying, and this is 40,000 times out from the Schwarzschild radius. That seems huge, but it was the best evidence yet for the existence of a supermassive black hole at the time. But the theorists went to work and came up with lots of alternatives to a supermassive black hole. And, you know, I called this job security because it meant we had to keep going. And that's what we did. This is the central arc second again. And now these stars are moving, not moving on straight lines because we've watched for long enough. And you'll see I project forward a little bit here. So this star, it turns out, is one of the most important stars because it goes around in a mere 15 years. So that means we've actually already seen almost the entire orbit. The other star that I have to say is one of my favorites is this guy, because if you'll notice, it comes in and then makes a complete U-turn going around. So these things get within roughly the size of the Sun-Pluto distance. I guess I have to apologize that we kicked them out of the Pluto out of the solar system, but you know it actually did make some sense. But they're going very fast at the at their closest approach. They move at about 12,000 kilometers per second, which is like 10 million miles per hour, which to me is a number that's hard to conceive of. But now, from every single star that goes around, I get a mass estimate. So this is the enclosed mass as a function of radius. This is what I got from the inpatient method, so I was way out here. Now, each star gives me a new estimate, and so we get basically the same number, but confined to a much smaller volume than before. In fact, it's a factor of 10,000 times better. And so we can say that the conclusion is inescapable, which is kind of almost like a bad joke. Okay, so we now have the strongest evidence for a super black hole in our galaxy, and it's in our own, which really is a wonderful opportunity for doing all sorts of other things. So what are we doing now? Well, I don't think the interest is in coming up with better evidence for a supermassive black hole or getting the mass down to more precision, but really it's now to turn the problem on its head to say, we really do think there is a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. Now I have an exquisite laboratory for understanding black holes because it's the closest one I get to study. But other ones are a factor of 100 times further away. So what are we doing? Just to name a few, some of the questions that we're pursuing are those that I never would have dreamed of asking going into this project. The first is, when and where are the stars born? This is interesting because some of the stars that we've been watching make these orbits, go around and around, are incredibly young. And young stars have no rights to be there, as I'll explain in just a second, very briefly. And then we'd like to know whether or not the black hole influences the appearance and evolution of the stars. We'd like to know how the black hole formed and evolved. And these are all things we can address by our detailed studies of the center of the galaxy. So just to give you a flavor for this, that one question, which has actually become my favorite one to study right now, is this question of young stars. And people say you should never show a spectrum in a public talk, only pictures. But this is the only spectrum I'm going to show, and it's not that bad. So a spectrum is simply how the light of different wavelengths, light of different wavelengths are emitted. So you can see that there's lots of this kind of light, and then there's an absorption light, less of this at this wavelength. And that just basically tells you that there's helium there. This tells you that there's hydrogen in the star. And the fact that there are these two lines, an astronomer would look at this and say, aha, you have a really hot star there. that's what you get out of that picture. Now, and it's quite hot. This is actually 30,000 degrees Kelvin. And if you tell an astronomer that they have a 30,000 degrees Kelvin star, what they're going to immediately assume is that you have a very young star, less than 10 million years old, which seems a lot like a big number, but actually compared to the age of most stars in our galaxy, this is very young. And to give you a sense, this would be like the age of this little guy that I'm particularly fond of him. He's a little older now, is compared to the age of the adult. And what you know about kids is if you see them, they probably form quite nearby. Okay, so this is true of these young stars. They're young, and they must have formed nearby. And it turns out that forming a star near a black hole is really hard. A black hole is a really violent, disruptive to any nursery that you might put near it. And the way you can understand this is that to get stars to form, you need a big ball of gas and dust to collapse under its own gravity. But what does a black hole do? A black hole has very strong gravity, and what that means is it's going to tug much more strongly on the near side of the object compared to the far side, which means it's going to shear it apart long before it gets a chance to collapse. So you don't get to form them. So I like to call this the paradox of youth. You have young stars where they're not supposed to be. And this has been a really fun field to work in because, again, the theorists have gone to work and come up with all sorts of explanations, a huge variety, and it means that the observers have to come up with better constraints on what's actually going on. So the first class of objects that, or solutions to this problem was the idea that maybe these are old stars masquerading as youths. It's a phenomenon we understand extremely well in Los Angeles. but the idea here is that you form a star really far away from the black hole, where it's not a problem, but you have plenty of time to get it inwards, into the neighborhood that's kind of unfriendly. And there are lots of forms of astronomical Botox to do this. And this bad joke can actually go on. So you need to make the star look hot. So what you can do is you can heat it, right? You can heat it by the black hole just to make the exterior part look hot. Or you can take off the cool outer layers. Stars are actually cooler on the outside, hotter in the middle. So if you take off the cool outer layer, you might see the hot star on the inside. So I guess this is the abrasion method. Okay, but as we know, in real life, these methods simply just don't work very well. So the other idea is that these really are young stars, but we formed them far away. And the problem there is that they're so young that you have to figure out some express bus to put them on to send them into the center of the galaxy before they age, because they're really just little guys. And we haven't been able to figure out a way to get them in fast enough, although people have thought of really cute ways. One is to invoke the idea of maybe there's intermediate mass black holes. Remember, I've told you about small guys, and I've told you about really big ones, and there are the middle ones. There's a mass range that we've never seen as a black hole. Well, maybe having those in the center of a star cluster could shepherd them in. The problem is we've never seen one, so you're invoking something we don't really understand very well. So that doesn't seem to work out too well. The last class of solution is perhaps these are young stars that really did form there. This means that the conditions when they formed had to be really different than what we see today. So maybe there was a tremendous amount of gas and dust, which form these stars. And what we see in the orbits, now that we've been tracking the orbits long enough, we can actually see the orbits of stars that are at much larger radii, and we actually see them starting to fall into a disk. So that's strong evidence that this idea is the right one, which means that perhaps our black hole was much more active in the past, because the gas that formed the star would have been accreted onto the black hole. So this means that maybe our black hole was more like an active galactic nuclei in its past than it is today. All right, so where are we going to go with all of this? Well, you know, astronomers are kind of greedy folks. We want bigger telescopes. And so the Keck telescope was a 10-meter telescope. There's plans now all across the world to build even larger telescopes. The Europeans are actually making the people in the U.S. look modest. They started at 100 meters. They scaled down to 50. Now they're at 42. It took me a long time to understand why 42. But at least it's the answer to the universe. It's also the square root of 2 times 30. They wanted to be bigger than the U.S. plan. So what do you get for building a larger telescope? Well, you know, every astronomer will tell you their favorite project, but this is mine, which is to do more orbital work. So I've done this animation that shows you what you see today on a scale that's even smaller than what I was showing you before. So this is only the fourth of the area. And you will see many more stars that are much deeper in the potential well of our galaxy. And this will allow us to make measurements that could test theories of how the black hole formed and how our galaxy formed, because it turns out we think that there's a synergy between the two. And it would also provide a test of general relativity and provide a useful test bed for understanding all sorts of things about stellar dynamics, which we can't do anywhere else in the universe. So I think this would be really cool. So, in conclusion, I hope, if nothing else, I've convinced you that we have a definitive case for a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And the great thing is it's in our very own backyard, which means we get to use it as a laboratory for understanding the astrophysics and consequences of supermassive black hole. And this is another wonderful Sid Harris cartoon that sums it up. It's black and it looks like a hole. I'd say it's a black hole. So in conclusion, I'm going to show you a 3D animation of these orbits just to give you a sense of when you spin this, what it looks like. And thanks for your attention. I'm happy to take questions.